Wildfires in the West, hurricanes in the East, concerns over escalating tension with North Korea, and a week ago, a mass shooting in Las Vegas. It's tough to know how to take it all in, not be overwhelmed or numb, and to figure out the best way to help where you can, while also letting go of the stress and sadness. We're discussing the ways you should consider risk and how we can help younger people understand a complex world. Today on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Colder temperatures are here, and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation reminds you of the danger of carbon monoxide, a poisonous gas that you can't see or smell. If it builds up in your home, it can be deadly. Be safe this winter and have a qualified mechanic ensure your heating system is working properly. Never run your car in the garage or operate a portable generator in an enclosed space. Finally, always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. We're talking today about how to assess risks. What does that mean? And what are the best ways to consider the factors that add risk to any endeavor, take reasonable precautions, and move forward? How do these assessments change our perceptions about the activities we choose to do? Now that we can more accurately determine risks, are there unintended consequences? Here to discuss how to put these questions into practice is Kevin Berry. Kevin is an ICER researcher who studies risk and building capacity for preparing for crisis events in a field, I hope I'm going to pronounce this correctly, called endogenous risk.
So that is correct, yes.
All right. We'll learn more about that in a minute. Thanks for being here, Kevin.
Thanks for having me.
And for insight into how schools can help young people deal with big events in the news that are scary and how they guide their thinking about risk is Dr. Kirsten Johnston-Strumpler, former Anchorage School District High School principal and current senior director of secondary education for the Anchorage School District. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me here today.
Thanks so much for being in. And also Julie Vensek is a counselor at King Career Center and has worked in the Anchorage School District for the past 27 years. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much to all three of you for being here. And to you, listeners, how do you handle risk? Are you overwhelmed by recent events? How do you deal with it without letting it consume your thoughts or interrupt your sleep? How do you decide what risk to take and which to avoid in your own life? You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255. That's statewide, 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Kevin, I want to start with you and the research that you do and have you describe that for us. As we mentioned in the open, your research field is called endogenous risk. Describe that for us. What does that mean?
Of course. So when we try to think about risks, we try to break them down into two different parts. First, there's the consequences of something bad happening, and then there's the probability of that thing occurring as well. And so we try and weight the consequences of something bad happening by the probability it will actually occur. And of course, we don't live in a world where we're unable to impact things. We're able to change our behavior. We're able to make decisions and think ahead. And so endogenous risk is when we take into account the fact that people can prevent things from occurring by reducing their probability. We can make bad events less likely to occur by adapting beforehand or once they occur to try and reduce the consequences. We can control events once they happen, or we can attempt to control them to reduce their spread. And so my research is focused on this sort of endogenous risk, focusing on pandemic outbreaks, wildfires, invasive species, and endemic disease as well. And now that I'm in Alaska, in addition to that, coastal erosion and all sorts of other problems as well.
Do you look at earthquakes?
Not yet. But it is something I'd be interested in working on, and that does tie into some of the things we're thinking about with coastal erosion, where you have several of the same issues are involved with that.
Especially now that you're in Alaska and we're in the Ring of Fire.
Yeah.
You wrote that your research, and you were just discussing, that your research deals with human response to catastrophes. How do you go about that research, and what does it reveal? How do you gather that information and calculate it, and what do you learn about it?
Of course. So we look at the human response to risk at a lot of different scales, from the national level to the individual level. And from a national level, we can often look at things that organizations like the CDC or FEMA are doing, to think about how they're reacting and being proactive towards risk. But on an individual level, we've used something called the American Time Use Survey, which is basically a minute-by-minute diary that people voluntarily participate in. And then the data is aggregated based on their different demographic characteristics. And we can look at how the average person spends their average day. And then we can also correlate this with different risks they might face. So during my time as a postdoc at Yale, we looked at how people were changing the amount of time they spent on outdoor recreation behavior in response to Lyme disease risk. And we found that people actually do spend less time outside, so they respond to the prevalence of Lyme disease risk in their geographic area. And so in response to a higher risk, they might choose to spend time instead watching TV or exercise indoors or do a lot of things that reduce their exposure. And we're actually hopefully going to be extending that project to look at whether or not they're also purchasing things like insect repellent to protect themselves.
And what does that tell you then? If people are limiting their outdoor activity, is it a dramatic decrease? And what else does that affect when they do that thing beyond just, you know, the health benefits of being outside and being active? What are the other kind of unintended consequences that can come about because of that?
Of course. So since the project was looking at daily averages, the daily change seems fairly small. It was about 1.5 minutes fewer outside on outdoor activity on average. But when you look at averages over the entire study area and over an entire year, this is about 10 fewer hours of outdoor recreation every single year, which is several trips. If we think about the time people invest to actually go somewhere and do something, this sums up to about $2.8 to $5 billion a year in the Northeast in reduced economic activity or reduced welfare. And so it's very important for me to also point out that this isn't money that's being spent, but this is simply because people are forced to switch from their preferred activity, which may be hiking, biking, or spending time outside, to instead spending time indoors, watching TV or doing something that they also enjoy, but not as much. And so this is in addition to all the costs of Lyme disease that are related to treatment, to morbidity and mortality, and just people feeling terrible because they've been infected with Lyme disease.
That is truly fascinating. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we are talking today about how to deal with crisis, how to calculate risk, how to take it in and think about it in a way that doesn't lock you up or make you numb or burn you out or stress you out. My guests are Kevin Berry. He's a researcher with the Institute of Social and Economic Research at University of Alaska Anchorage. Also in the studio is Dr. Kirsten Johnson-Strumpler, former Alaska Anchorage School District High School Principal and current Senior Director of Secondary Education for ASD. And Julie Vinsick is a counselor at King Career Center and has worked in the school district for the past 27 years. They're also joining us. And you can join our conversation if you have your own ways of dealing with the bad news cycle that we've been in for the past few months. How do you handle risk? Are you overwhelmed by recent events? How do you deal with it without letting it consume your thoughts or interrupt your sleep? How do you decide what risk to take and which to avoid? Join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK if you're calling statewide. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. An important part of dealing with crisis, whether local or at a distance, is helping young people understand it. Dr. Johnson-Strumpler, am I pronouncing that right?
Yep, mm-hmm. Strumpler.
Strumpler. So sorry.
That's okay.
As a former high school principal, what protocols did you use when a bad event occurred to inform students, especially in high school? And how did it vary depending on the type of event?
That's a great question. There's a lot of different aspects you look at as a principal when you're thinking about issues that will really affect your student body. And I think the first thing that we really focus on is prevention. Like if we're talking about natural disasters or a violent intruder or something along those lines, the key is really being prepared for those events at school and talking about them before they occur and training staff and students for the in crisis response that we would like to protect them the best that we can. So we do a lot of drills. We train staff during in-service times, and it's a regular occurring preparation that happens at the school level. But then there's the emotional aftermath of those events that we deal with probably more so than the actual events taking place at school. And typically, schools are where young people come to share their experiences and get that help that they need to work through a lot of issues that are happening, whether that's in the national news or more locally or even with a peer that sits next to them in math class. So we respond to a lot of those human factors in a lot of different ways. Some kids need just to talk through those issues, and so we provide support services, and Julie's here today, and she sees that firsthand as a school counselor. And we also have more systematic things that we do where we have crisis response teams that come to our schools to help in times of need. So it's a multi-layered preparation and response that we have at the school level.
It's interesting that what you're talking about in preparation is sort of the field of research that Kevin is engaged in, calculating risk and and then trying to plan for that as best that you can.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, our idea is that parents send their children to us every day. We take that very seriously as a education group. And so we want to protect them like they are our own kids when they're in our care at school. And so we want to make sure that we have planned and prepared as much as humanly possible for anything that comes our way. So unfortunately, a lot of it is not good these days.
Yeah, it's been a particularly kind of a terrible, traumatic news cycle as of late. Julie Vincek, you work as a counselor at King Career Center currently and have been with the school district for nearly 30 years. Mm-hmm. How has the role of a school counselor changed in the 27 years that you've been doing it? News events are much closer and they're constant now. How is that affecting young people and how you work with them to help them handle it all?
Sure. Good question, Lori. So, you know, I think it's changed in many ways, but if we're looking at accessibility and how our young people get that news, I mean, I think that's probably the biggest change. You know, it used to be students would come to school, maybe something happened in our community or at the national level, and staff would convene. We'd prepare how we were going to talk to our students. We'd go into the classrooms or bring students together, share that news with them. But now, chances are, our students are getting that information before we are. It's not uncommon to go to bed at 11 o'clock at night and wake up at 6 in the morning, and your live stream is coming at you full force on phone, on computer, on the radio, on the TV, and students sometimes are left in those couple of hours before they even get to school or are talking to parents to kind of filter that and figure out what is coming at them. So it's changed in that they have this rapid accessibility with limited filter capacity when things are coming at us fast and furious like they have been lately.
And do you find, is there a difference in how young people process that level of information today as opposed to a couple of decades ago?
You know, I think so. First of all, I mean, we know that we, as human beings, we tend to feed off of each other. So when large groups of people are getting inundated with information that is not such great information, they tend to talk to each other to kind of feed off of that. So that's, I think, one big piece of what they're dealing with. I think the thing that our young people are telling us, you know, loud and clear is what they really need is they need people to sit down with them, people to hear them out, people to validate what they're feeling. They want to know that their thoughts are being heard and are real. They want to know that they're safe, like Dr. Johnson Strumpler talked about. It's a time when we really have to reiterate in our schools that you are safe and people are here to take care of you. So, yeah.
This is Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and we are discussing how to deal with bad news, how to talk to young people about it. And you can join our conversation. How do you mitigate risk in making decisions in your life? How do you respond after a crisis? Do you pitch in and help if it's local, send money if it's at a distance? How do you decide? 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Kevin, I want to back up to you for a second here. You've talked a little bit about this, but you've researched the risk of pandemic disease outbreaks. Tell us how you go about developing those calculations and then what it means to build capacity to deal with those with a crisis. We had a really interesting conversation by phone the other day, and I found that part of it so interesting, the capacity building part. So tell us about how you calculate it and then what the capacity building means.
Of course. So particularly for pandemics, there's one key difficulty, which is actually a very good thing, which is that they're fortunately very rare. And so we've thought in particular about pandemic influenza outbreaks. And so there's in the past been one massive outbreak in 1918, which actually killed more people than the First World War. But when we talk about the probability of them occurring, we look over the last, say, 100 years. There have been three candidate outbreaks that you could feasibly call a pandemic. There was the 1918 one and two in the 1950s. And so we basically have to extrapolate and say that there's about a 3 out of 100 chance that this is going to happen in a given year, so about a 3% chance in a given year. And we might call this the arrival rate. So this is where terms like a 1 in 100 year event come from. And then we have to tie this to the consequences. And particularly for pandemics and diseases with anything that includes human mortality, these estimates are not necessarily correct because, of course, if it's a family member or anybody you know, it's catastrophic. Especially the value of mortality is typically a poor estimate of infinity. But we are able to use some economic estimates based on reduced activity, so people not going outside and not going to work and not participating in trade. We're able to come up with estimates that, again, are low compared to what everybody, I think, individually would agree they should be, but estimates for mortality and morbidity, and so the amount of treatment people need and their foregone activity. There's actually an interesting literature that looks at people foregoing flights during the Ebola or the influenza outbreaks. And so they had booked flights previously and they'd spent money to go. And then because of the outbreak, they forwent those trips. And so this is some sort of willingness to pay to avoid risk. And so then we try and combine those numerical consequences. So those estimates in a dollar value of the damages with the probability something occurs. And then my research is taking the next step where the endogenous risk comes in, where we then say, okay, how can we go about reducing the probability of these things occurring? And so for a large amount of our research, we thought about prevention. So the next pandemic is likely to come from a few specific locations, which happen to be overseas. And so we asked, well, what if we built preemptively healthcare capacity there? We built hospitals, we had beds, or we at least had doctors ready to be sent there. And there's already institutions and groups like this. There's the CDC, there's the Global Outbreak and Response Network through the World Health Organization.
Doctors Without Borders.
Of course, Medicine Sans Frontières. I apologize, mm-hmm. Doctors Without Borders. They were one of the first groups to respond to the Ebola outbreak and did a really admirable job. And so we have this healthcare capacity to reduce the probability of a small local outbreak becoming a global pandemic. And then we simultaneously looked at building capacity within the United States to deal with an outbreak. So the first part would have been prevention. And then if we're thinking about costs only from a U.S.-centric point of view, building capacity in the United States would be considered adaptation. And this is building hospitals, having spare hospital beds, having extra doctors. So one of the, when I was writing my dissertation, which this was part of, one of my favorite commercials that was on TV at the time was a gentleman walking through a hospital saying there are all these empty beds and this place is not maximizing profit and they're foregoing returns to their shareholders and we'll find the place that's not doing that. And that was, of course, the opposite of what my research would suggest, is that you need a lot of empty hospital beds and a lot of available nurses so that if there is a catastrophic outbreak, there's somebody there to treat people and there's a place to go. And, I mean, especially for the pandemic work, the expected damages truly are catastrophic for pandemic influenza. We're talking numbers close to $3 trillion. I mean, these are damages that rival climate change. And there could be greater capacity to mitigate these things. And so there's actually large savings in expected damages if we construct more capacity to mitigate or prevent these outbreaks, on the tune of a 10-to-1 return on some of these investments. So we also looked at Ebola. Sort of timely, we wrote those papers on pandemic prevention, and then the Ebola outbreak happened. And so we redid the analysis using numbers from Sierra Leone and the other impacted countries and asked what should have been spent to prevent this. And we came up with a number that was fairly close to what Congress allocated during the outbreak. And we argued that this should be spent on long-term prevention. So rather than just fighting the most recent outbreak, we should build capacity to prepare for the next outbreak, similar to how the United States keeps a standing army in case there is ever a national security issue where we need to rapidly be able to deploy somebody to prevent that. And so in that case, we found that the return to trying to prevent the next Ebola outbreak would be roughly 10-to-1, which is in expected terms, of course. So there's damages that would be paid in the future weighted by the probability of an outbreak actually occurring.
Mm-hmm. Are you finding that it seems like getting traction with the idea that we need to build hospitals that are empty just so that they're there in case we need them, you'd have a hard time getting traction politically with something like that. Maybe not. I don't know. But it seems like that would be a difficult conversation. Do you find that the systems that are in place, are they getting better at those kinds of responses? You know, the horrific shooting that happened in Las Vegas overwhelmed the hospitals there. But there's ways that people respond by creating sort of mobile places to put people temporarily. Are those systems getting better? You gave this great example of a standing army or a standing military that's ready to respond. Are there better systems in place now than maybe when you first started looking at these things and how people mitigate and calculate risk than in the past as far as a quicker response to help mitigate?
So depending on the timescale you're looking at, of course, I'm not certain in particular how quickly it's increasing currently. But when we think about things like the hurricane hitting Puerto Rico, there was a hospital ship available to be sent down there. And a hospital ship, for those who don't know, is basically a large mobile hospital on the water that you can send anywhere in the world on short notice. And so we do have a lot of existing capacity to respond to these outbreaks. Particularly for the pandemic work, that's more focusing on something that's worldwide and fortunately, very rare.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. We are talking about how to deal with crisis and calculating risk. And you can join our conversation if you'd like to discuss how you mitigate those things in your own life, how you talk to your children about them, and how you decide what risks to take and which risks not to, which to avoid. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Bob is in Cordova. Hi, Bob.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, this is kind of on a micro experience, but I just wanted to share my experiences of working on the water for many, many years. And if you have three things that are going against you, you really better consider what you're doing. It could be the wind against the tide, and it could be daylight. A little thing on a little day is just a little thing, but a little thing on an adverse environment could be a very, very big thing. And that also applies to winter driving in Alaska. I've been in some horrific storms that I didn't want to be there, and I wish I would have taken measures to do anything different. And aside from that, I just want to mention if you're on the water, have a life vest for sure. And if you're driving, wear your seatbelt. So that's about all I have to say. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Bob, for the call. And he's talking about how to mitigate risk. Make sure you have a life vest with you when you're on the water. Absolutely. Smart advice that everyone should listen to, and also It was interesting that he brought up seatbelts because, Kevin, that's an area of research that you and I talked about. And it's one of those things that was a surprising to me anyway, an unintended consequence of when seatbelts came into being. Describe a little bit about what that was when people started to use seatbelts.
Of course. So there is this concept out there called the moral hazard, which is the idea that if you provide some sort of public insurance to people or some sort of widespread protection, individuals may choose to take higher risks. And so in the case of seatbelts, of course, seatbelts became mandated. They were suddenly in every car everywhere. But in response, people drove faster. And so whether or not there was an absolute reduction in risk, I would still argue yes, but it's not clear that it's as large as it otherwise would have been had people not changed their driving habits in response. And this happens with most concepts. So, of course, we mentioned having a life jacket. People may be more likely to take a risk if they're mandated to carry a life jacket. Now, of course, the absolute reduction in risk makes it so that you should always, always, always have a life jacket. But you may be more likely to go out on a day that it's not as safe if you're carrying one than if you were forced to otherwise swim back to shore.
So, was there any way to really determine how much faster people drove or how much more the risk increased after seatbelts became common?
Sure. So I think in this particular literature, they looked at increased accident rates. And so accidents actually went up. But of course, the consequences of those accidents went down because more people were buckled in and they were safe once the accident occurred.
All right. We're talking about risk and how to mitigate it, how to deal with the bad news cycle, whether that's local or at a distance, it's still quite close to us in today's ubiquitous 24/7 media world, and how to talk to young people about it. We will take your calls and questions and continue our conversation after a short break as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by...
Support for Alaska Public Media comes from Raven Alaska, committed to customer safety and satisfaction, reminding Alaska that now is a great time to fly. Learn more at flyravn.com. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation reminds you that technology for your home is smarter than ever. New devices and apps can simplify tasks, make better use of resources, and transform the way we live. Learn how to update your home with smart technologies at Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's free smart home class on October 25th. Learn more and register at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and we are talking today about dealing with crisis, calculating risk, and how to manage it all in your life and helping young people deal with it as well. I've found that sometimes I have to make myself step away from the flood of information. And, you know, as a news junkie, that's particularly hard for me. But it's important, I think, to close a laptop, put the phone down, turn off the radio, have some silence. Take a walk with no earbuds in. And I'm wondering if you encourage silent time for young people, Dr. Johnson Strempler or Julie, when you're working with young people, do you encourage them to really unplug at times? And how successful are you or aren't you with that, Dr. Johnson?
I think it depends on what age student you're dealing with at a school setting. Clearly, teenagers are attached to their devices these days, and so it is a more challenging thing to encourage at the high school level. But we do encourage kids to be involved in a whole lot of activities at school, not just anything that's plugged in, essentially. So we want to see them doing healthy extracurricular activities. We want to see them joining clubs at school, things that don't revolve around news media or electronic information and those types of things. So so I wouldn't say that we have like an attack on, you know, electronics necessarily, but we do want them to find healthy activities to engage their mind in problem solving and coping strategies and building self-confidence and all of those good things. So.
Julie,
sure, I might just add to what Dr. Johnson-Strumpler said. And it's, I think, really important for us to try to teach our young people. It's such a teachable moment when we take a look at if being plugged into your phone or the news or whatever may be happening is causing anxiousness and agitation or you're feeling overwhelmed. You know, what a great opportunity to talk about that and say, you know, what can we do to teach you to step back from that, to kind of self-regulate, to maybe take a break, go and talk to a friend, talk to a counselor, talk to a parent, go for a walk, do an activity. But that's a life skill that we would really hope our young people have, and I think it's part of our responsibility to help them with that. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I mean, one of the things that we really, or at least I stressed as the principal, is that electronics are going to be a part of your adult life. And, you know, intaking media and news stories that may be troublesome are going to be a part of your life. So our job is to teach kids how to cope with those things as they come in their life and working with electronics so that you're appropriate in your adult life is part of our job in schools.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk a little more about that specifically, but I also want to invite other Alaskans to join us. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. If you want to let us know how you mitigate risk in making decisions in your life, how you respond after a crisis, how you help out if that's what you decide to do, and how do you decide? 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can email us your questions or comments at talk@alaskapublic.org. So shocking, terrible events that didn't occur locally felt more distant when I was a kid. You might see an article in the weekly paper. Before there was 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week media, it brings it so much closer to our lives in real time. How do you think this is affecting how young people view the world as opposed to 30 years ago when there was less access? Julie, what has your experience been in your tenure with working with students?
Sure. Well, I think, first of all, if the news that we hear, and especially what's been happening lately, doesn't overwhelm all of us, something's wrong with us. But I think for young people, you know, when it does keep coming at you kind of rapid fire, their main objective is they want to sit down and have somebody talk them through, this doesn't make sense to me, what is happening? And so to be accessible to our young people, whether you're a parent, whether you're a friend, whether you're a counselor, and kind of taking the conversation, let them guide you through that conversation. For some people, you know, they're going to have a lot of questions. For some people, they just want to talk out loud so they can make sense of it. For some people, it will connect them to past incidences, maybe trauma, maybe significant loss and traumatic stress, definitely. So really letting that young person kind of guide you to what needs to be done, what you can help them with at that time.
When you when I think back to, you know, managing that for my children when there were bad news events, it was so much easier than it is now. How do you help parents to figure out what is and isn't okay as far as how much access young people have and what's age appropriate?
Sure. Well, and others might want to chime in too, but I think the most important thing is for parents to remember you can manage in the home anyway, you know, how much TV is being shown, how much of the news you're watching repetitively. And another thing we don't always think of, but young people take their cues off of adults. They're looking at adults to see, how are you reacting to this? How are you managing this? What are you thinking about this? And we sometimes forget that because there's such an impact with this. I mean, I know how I felt when I heard about the Las Vegas shootings impacted our family on a very personal level. And then to know that, you know, you have young eyes and ears looking at you saying, You know, how do you feel about this? And what are you saying? And so I think that's really important for us also then to not only model how we're managing it, but to show our children, you know what, we're going to take a break. Let's go out for a walk. You know, we're going to turn the TV off. Let's sit down and play a board game. Or we're going to turn the TV off and we're going to talk about this. Tell us how you feel about it. We want to hear that. So modeling that, I think, in a very calm way is very important for our young people.
I would definitely add that having the relationship with your children at home where they can ask you those questions is important too, because that's not always present. You need to develop that trusting relationship with your kids where they can ask you all of those things that they're wondering about inside. Because if you can't talk and process those things as a young person, that definitely builds up, and then you start to see other types of behavior, such as acting out or self-destructive types of behavior. And so having that dialogue at home is really important. And you can only get there if it's a regular occurring thing and you have that trust with your son or daughter at home.
Definitely.
It reminds me at its most basic and simple, when kids are really small, if they fall down, they immediately look at you and look at what your reaction is.
Right.
And if you say, uh-oh, and kind of smile and say, better get up. Or if you say, oh, no.
Right.
You know, their reaction usually mirrors what yours is.
Definitely.
Yep, definitely.
People in Alaska, this is more of a local thing that's causing stress. People are upset about crime rates. We've had a lot of stories in our newscasts of late about citizen reaction to crime, comments related to opioid overdoses or property crime. At recent political meetings, has suggested that people... Some comments have said people should not be revived after they've been, if they've had to try to revive somebody that's overdosed on opioids more than a few times, then they should just be left to die. Or a homeowner said he wouldn't call police if his home was being broken into until there's a corpse to pick up. Do you see this as just sort of a natural frustration boiling out and people are saying things that maybe they don't truly mean, or they're just exasperated? Or does a constant diet of terrible news, and Kevin, this might be something that you can weigh in on too in your research, does this constant diet of bad news burn out people's capacity for compassion?
So I do think there is a risk of people becoming burned out with too much bad news. And then I think also oftentimes when we look at these events, it's difficult to tease out what exactly is causing what to occur. So I know oftentimes the backlash towards crime is directed towards SB 91, and there was that recent event I think you were referring to where one of my colleagues from the Justice Center pointed out that it's really difficult to know what is driving the increase in crime right now. Of course, that's no consolation to people who are victims of crime or who, of course, from my work, feel that they need to change their behavior to protect themselves. And so I think I don't have a really well-informed professional opinion on this because I'm not super familiar with the literature related directly to crime, but I think it is possible people can get burned out, and it's difficult to tell people that we have to wait for more information to know what's going on. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, sometimes that is true, and we have to make decisions with less than full information.
Yeah, absolutely true. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide if you'd like to talk about how you mitigate risk, manage crisis in your lives, how you work with the younger people in your lives to help them understand it all and not be overwhelmed. 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK statewide, or 550-8422, 550-8422 in Anchorage. You can also email us talk@alaskapublic.org. Julie, from a counselor's standpoint, what are your thoughts about that when we're barraged, as we have been in recent months, just with a seemingly endless stream of terrible events, both nationwide, worldwide. Do you think that this does burn out people's capacity for compassion, or are we more resilient than that?
Well, I think it's probably a combination of both. I think it's very natural to feel burned out. I think it's very natural to feel like you're just kind of fed up. You don't know what to do next. I think those are very predictable thought processes. However, that being said, I think that, I mean, our nation has quite a history of showing that, you know, we really rise in cooperation in times of crisis. So I think people being resilient is innate. I think great things can come from this and from the news that we've been hearing. I mean, I know when Dr. Johnson and I were talking about the other day that, you know, so much good comes out of it. Young people coming forward saying, I want to do something different. I want to be part of our school community. I want to be involved in a group or an action that's going to make things better. You know, heroes rise from all avenues, which we have seen time and time again, and especially the natural disasters, including what happened in Las Vegas. But I just think, you know, that innate part where people are good and they want to do something to right a wrong comes out in so many people. And I think we actually become better people when we're faced with a lot of this adversity. And we've seen time and time again that happening. So, you know, I'm very hopeful that as tired as we get, as burned out as we get, we can also look around. And if we're really paying attention, we can see some pretty incredible things that are coming as a result of some of this.
Dr. Johnson-Strumpler, do you want to weigh in a little bit there on compassion burnout or how young people may be dealing with maybe the fact that there's the kind of the blessing curse aspect of it, that it's closer and can be overwhelming, but it's also closer, so it feels closer, and maybe people respond in kind?
Yeah, I think I would add that all of those things are coping strategies, whether they're by young people or adults. And so I think that you know, when we look at the positive side of things, as Julie was mentioning, that's our either our young people or even our adult world of processing a tragic event and how we're going to move on from that. And a lot of positive can come from that as a result of coping. Other folks don't necessarily have that healthy coping strategy, so they may say things that they probably don't mean. Or maybe they do mean them, and that's their way of processing the event. And I think, you know, getting back to kids and young people, which is my background, our job at the school level is to point children or students in the right direction of how to positively cope with these things and talk through the thought process that's involved there when a tragic event happens and maybe they have an angry response or say things that they don't mean. We talk through those things into a more positive coping strategy for them so that they can learn from the event.
Mm-hmm. And actually, if I can,
Kevin, please.
If I can say something quickly, too, a lot of these different strategies are basically social cohesion, which is incredibly valuable when it comes to reacting to catastrophes. And it's important that we build up our communities and things like that, not only after bad events occur, but beforehand. It never hurts to know your neighbors and to build these sort of social networks that help us cope after things happen.
It's kind of that statement of when we experience the worst, we become our best. And I agree with Kevin. I think we're seeing a lot more of that. And I just wanted to add one thing to Dr. Johnson-Stumpler's piece. And that is that, you know, a lot of times if we're looking at the schools, our principals, our counselors, our teachers, I mean, all school staff in general, kind of become the first responders for the emotional side of our students. And I think, you know, a piece that we really need to put out there for all people at a time like this is that whole piece on self-care. You know, if we're not taking care of ourselves, it's pretty hard to be there for other people as well. And again, it's something that we can model to our young people that it's essential to do. So I just wanted to throw that piece in there.
Yeah, it's very true that if your own well is empty, you can't help replenish someone else's. Let's go back to the phones again. And we have a caller from Kasilov. Hello, is it Leif?
Yes, that's correct.
Hi, Leif. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, I want to talk on two subjects. I'm just old enough to remember the panic over polio. And I'm also old enough that in elementary school, we were marched into the elementary school auditorium and went up on stage to get the first of the Salk vaccine polio shots. And we almost eliminated it in this country, and now polio is coming back. And I don't know if that's considered a pandemic. I'd like to hear whether it is or not. But I'd like to add to that this refusal of people to get their children vaccinated has caused a number of things to come back that we have almost eradicated. And if that's going to be, you know, a major crisis somewhere along the line. And the other thing on preparedness I'm a member of CERT, Community Emergency Response Team, and they have periodic training down here, and it prepares you for really big emergencies. We don't have hurricanes, but we have volcanoes, we have earthquakes, so forth. And also, I've taken the CISM training, CISM, Crisis Intervention Stress, Crisis Intervention Stress Management. And there's an additional training in that where you become a counselor. You go out to an immediate emergency, say a family member has been killed in an auto accident or in a burning house, and you help people in just a short time, maybe an hour. You try to help them figure out whether they need more professional help than you can give, and you steer them to it if necessary. And we have, my wife and I have developed quite a extensive collection of basic medical emergency gear, gauze, bandages, and so forth and so on, quite a bit more than people have in their medicine chest. In fact, I think we take up two or three plastic tubs of it. Because here in Alaska, it's a question of not if a volcano is going to go off, it's when. And I think we can say the same thing about earthquakes. The training for CERT, I think, is evening work, and I can't remember. It might be 2 weeks. It might be only one. And then there's refresher drills at least once a year, maybe twice.
Interesting. And so,
which are not necessarily mandatory. Anyway, I'd like to hear all your thoughts on that,
well,
and I'll take my...
Before you go, but before you go, Leif, let me just ask one follow-up question here. Did you decide to take this training because other support services are at a great distance from where you live, or are you just someone who feels sort of a community responsibility to be as prepared as you can personally with that type of training to help? I mean, it's quite admirable that you take this training and you're prepared for other people's emergencies beyond your own. What motivated you to do that?
Well, two things. After 30 plus years in Ketchikan, we moved up here in 06, and we had a fire on our road, the North Coho Loop. It was only 67 acres, but it had with all the dead spruce, we were just lucky they got it out, very lucky. Then the Caribou Hills fire came around, and we organized FireWise. They still had the spruce bark beetle office here in the Kenai Peninsula borough, and we ended up getting in touch with them, getting help from them. That was also another community preparedness thing.
Mm-hmm.
I and a friend helped organize it for our area. We helped people with disabilities or seniors who couldn't do the work to clear their property anymore. And so forth. We went, there was an evaluation process which was free and which was not turned into any organization. But it was kind of a checklist where we went to a piece of property, told them, okay, you need to clear this vegetation back in your house and so forth.
Mitigating risk.
So that got me started, and that just segued into CERT, Community Emergency
sure.
Response Team. And it was some of the same people here that got us into that.
All right.
And then it was there was a shooting, a hostage case on the Alaska State Ferries 2000 and, oh boy, maybe it was 98 or thereabouts. And that's when I got introduced to CISM because they took a number of people who got involved in that and they held the meetings about that. And those are closed to anybody who wasn't part of it.
Well, this is so interesting, and as I said, it's admirable that you took those extra steps. I remember when I took CPR training and thinking, wow, this is something that I'm doing, I'm taking the time to learn that I can never help myself with. But I really liked the idea that in an emergency, maybe I could help save someone's life. And so it's great that people step up and do those things to help out their neighbors, their family, their community. So good on you. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more about risk and get some response from Kevin about vaccinations, polio, and mitigating that risk as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation reminds you that winter is almost here, and that means higher energy bills. On October 25th, AHFC is offering Secrets and Science of Energy Efficiency, a free class about the value of energy improvements at home. Learn best practices and money-saving tips. Learn more and register at Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's website at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable Public Radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact this station to learn more.
All right, welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Kevin, our last caller, talked about a wide range of things, being prepared for emergencies, and also his frustration over folks who don't want to get vaccinations. Talk a little bit about what's known about that risk, mitigating those risks when it comes to vaccinating your kids.
Oh, of course. So from the medical literature that I'm familiar with, there is no risk from vaccinations, or at least none that compares with the actual risk of getting those diseases themselves. Most vaccines are either dead virus, in which case you can't get sick from it, or they're introduced at a time where, of course, medical professionals have made sure there's not a risk of you actually getting sick from the vaccine. So that's absolutely safe, and it's a good idea to vaccinate your kids because it also provides additional insurance to people who can't get vaccinated. So some people do have compromised immune systems, and they can't be vaccinated. There's a wide variety of medical conditions that are all individually awful that can explain why someone would be unable to be vaccinated. And through a phenomenon called herd immunity, we protect those people. So if you think about yourself standing in a gym with 100 other people, and two people in that group are infected with, say, influenza, if nobody's vaccinated, influenza, if you're in that gym long enough, can move through and infect pretty much everybody in that gym, all 100 people. If instead I vaccinate some percentage, say 50%, and I have 50%, that 50% of people stand in the middle of the gym and protect 25 people, and there's 25 people on the other side of the gym next to the infected individuals, I can reduce the spread of the disease, and maybe only the 25 people on the right-hand side of the gym next to the infected people are at risk. And of course, as I get closer and closer to 100% of the people in the room, I can have 3-4 individuals who have some legitimate medical condition where they can't be vaccinated in the room, but they're protected through herd immunity because everyone else in the room has already been vaccinated. And so the caller mentioned, for instance, polio almost being eradicated. There are issues, of course, with eradicating something worldwide because you have to provide vaccinations all around the world, which is incredibly costly and difficult. And I believe there was issues with people trusting medical professionals in the developing world towards the end of that vaccination program, which reduced its effectiveness. But basically, if a vaccine has reached the point where it's widespread, it is safe, it's been studied widely, and in that case, it provides a lot of insurance and a lot of protection to people who are otherwise at risk.
Mm-hmm. What did you call that, herd immunity?
Yes, herd immunity is basically the concept that if you reach a high enough percentage in a population that is vaccinated, it protects everybody who's not. Mm-hmm. Simply because if I'm, say, I had the flu today and everyone in this room is vaccinated, I can't possibly infect your family members. But if you're not vaccinated, I can infect you, and then you could take that disease home and infect your entire family.
And that's how pandemics get rolling.
Yes.
Let's go to the phones for just a quick moment here. Donna is in Anchorage. Hi, Donna.
Hi. I'm calling because there's simple things that two things people can do when they're driving in the winter that would cause a lot of less accidents to occur. One is they forget a lot of times how slippery the roads are, and they tailgate, and you have to leave a lot more room. A lot of the accidents in the wintertime are because we don't leave enough space between the vehicles when you're driving. And the second one is those bright lights that are so popular that allow the drivers to see better, but they blind people coming toward them. If they could reduce them and put them on low beams when cars are approaching, it would keep a lot of people from being blinded on the highways.
Mitigating risk, absolutely. Thank you so much for the call, Donna. In our last couple of minutes that we have here, Kevin, the one thing that I wondered about in your research especially is the unpredictable nature of climate change. If you're trying to calculate risk, it's throwing chaos into natural systems. How can you calculate that risk in this mix of unpredictability with climate change?
Of course, it's a very complicated issue, and there's a wide variety of people who have taken very different approaches to doing this. And The issue is that oftentimes our models downplay the overall risk because we're focused on what's most likely to happen. But there are very few but very low probability events that are truly catastrophic. And humans have a hard time dealing with catastrophic low probability risks. I mean, if, for instance, somebody tells you there's a 1 in 1,000 chance of something occurring and then an entire city will be destroyed, it's hard to really figure out what one should do to respond to that because, of course, the consequences are terrible and we would never want to face them, but the probability of it occurring is already so small. And so when we talk about the potential outcomes, there is this large, what scientists might call fat tail, where the worst consequences are absolutely terrible, atrocious, awful things we never want to deal with, but they're fairly low probability. And so at least in my work, we try and isolate individual events that are driven by climate change. For instance, increased probability of pandemics occurring, invasive species, and of course now hurricanes are becoming stronger. It's not necessarily causing more hurricanes, but it's sort of loading the dice that we have stronger hurricanes and possibly more frequent. And so we try and look at those individual risks and take sort of a bite out of the apple rather than trying to deal with the whole issue at once.
And to Dr. Johnson Strumpfler and also Julie Vincek, how do you talk to students about these things that we really can't factor in or really be sure of when we're talking about how to mitigate risk? There are a lot of unpredictable things. Climate change is one of them. A mass shooting, such as the horrible event in Las Vegas, people at a concert. No one would be thinking about mitigating that type of risk. How do you talk to kids about these things that are so frightening, yet you really can't figure out how to guard against?
That's a great question. I think that one of the things that's really important, depending on the developmental age of the students or young people that you're talking to, is to talk to it in terms that they can understand and process. And I think another important factor is to be very honest about how likely something like that is to happen and talk through that in a developmentally appropriate way, and to use real terms, not to say to, like, if someone has passed, to not say they went to sleep or something along those lines, that you want to say that they died, or they went to heaven, depending on your beliefs. You want to use real terms that kids will understand and process that through with them. So. Mm-hmm.
Julian, a couple seconds here.
Sure. I think just, you know, to reiterate what everybody else is saying, to be there, to be present. Mm-hmm. For parents, they know their children the best. If you notice anything that's out of the ordinary, sleep patterns, eating, be on top of it. And there's a lot of good people in the schools there waiting for your kids when they come each day.
Thanks so much to my guests. Thank you, Alaskans, for listening in. There's more information at our website. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Colder temperatures are here, and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation reminds you of the danger of carbon monoxide, a poisonous gas that you can't see or smell. If it builds up in your home, it can be deadly. Be safe this winter and have a qualified mechanic ensure your heating system is working properly. Never run your car in the garage or operate a portable generator in an enclosed space. Finally, always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This program is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. This is Alaska Public Media.